one of the sort of early introduction, or not invention, but sort of description of open systems theory was around the environment. So conceptualizing the environment that an organization or a group is sort of part of. Like in the industrial era, we assumed that things were predictable. There was competition, but it was all about, you know, winning the mound, like becoming the king of the hill or whatever it was. Like, you have to win the market. So it's all about strategy and all that stuff and getting the right people and cost cutting and all that stuff. That works in one certain environment where things are fairly predictable. But the thing is that the environment that we are in now is highly unpredictable. And that's where complexity comes in. That's where the open system theory really shines, is because they take that in fully. You can't predict anything. Everything is unpredictable. So you have to create an organization that can adapt to anything. That's when you need the full brain power of the whole organization. You can't just rely on some brilliant person at the top.
Hello, hello everybody, and welcome back to the Boundaryless Conversations podcast. On this podcast, we meet with pioneers, thinkers, and doers, and we talk about the future of business models, organizations, markets, and society in our rapidly changing world. Today, I'm joined by two exceptional individuals who are united by their profession as kind of organizational consultants, let's say. João Rosa and Trond Hjorteland, I hope I pronounced it well. João is an experienced organizational coach who works with organizations that wants to transition into the so-called fast flow operating models. He is also part of the Team Topology's value practitioner team, very close to the core team that, by the way, we already had on the podcast. So listeners, you can check a previous episode we had with Matthew Skelton. And also one of the co-authors of Software Architecture Metrics, a book from O'Reilly, and one of the curators of the Visual Collaboration Tools book. Trond defines himself as a socio-technical practitioner with many years of experience with large and complex organizations. And he works, I would say, at the convergence between technology and organizations, coupling techniques and concepts that span from agile practices, whole-scale organizational change, and collaborative sense-making and design. Hello, both of you, Trond and João. Fantastic to have you with us today.
Thank you very much for having us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
Let me tell just a bit of where all this conversation started. I met with João at the Avans Coperta retreat organized by our friends at Avans Coperta. Again, you know, you can check Alberto Brandolini's episode on the podcast. And it was a moment where we were running an open space technology conference, and I proposed a session on what was a kind of a provocative question. I asked, you know, the audience, how do we avoid building agile bureaucracies, right? That was the question. And thankfully, João and another person, and a common friend, Jacopo, showed up at the session, and we had a very interesting initial conversation. And this led me to know more of Trond's work as well, because João shared it with me on open systems theory, which is something that we're going to discuss more openly during the conversation today. So as a starting point, maybe both of you, you can take a few minutes to kind of share with our audience, where are you, where is your work now as deeply informed practitioners around socio-technical systems? So what is your thinking that at the moment, let's say, around everything related to how do we organize, how do we produce great outcomes in technology, imbued organizations, and in general on socio-technical systems?
I have been working as an architect for many few years. Done a fair bit of coding before that, but I haven't coded for many years. But I've been doing architecture, and I often refer to myself as the sort of the reluctant architect, because I do not feel like I can architect anything for anyone, really. I can help, I can assist, I can sort of bring my ideas and, of course, experience and all that, but it's not my position to do so. I never felt that was there. So I always felt that it was natural for me to bring in the teams and like do this together. So that's probably why I sort of ended up enjoying domain-driven design so much, especially the community, about the focus on the collaborative aspects of things. So at my current client and also my previous ones, I always intended or worked towards doing that together with the teams and organizations themselves. So not saying that I'm only facilitating, because it's more of a mix, but I'm not doing it alone. And I know you mentioned earlier, and I've read things from you, that you were inspired by Hire, right? And actually, I read a paper quite a few years ago, which I didn't know was Hire back then, because I don't think they were named, but they were talking about all this micro-enterprise thing. Because I've been into service-oriented architecture for a long time, and it's kind of never felt right with me about the organization, because it never seemed to fit. All of the technical bits, and then there's less about the organization, or next to nothing about the organization. So when I go in now, like for a current client, I try to mix those two. Like, you can't just focus on the technical bits, even if you're doing service-oriented. You have to also bring on board teams. And if you create services, you have to think about teams as well, right? So they have to be so aligned. So I guess that's where I sort of bumped into socio-technical at some point and liked the term. I think it started there. So I started digging into some papers, which turned into loads of papers, because this is academia after all. What I've ended up doing now is like combining domain-driven design, socio-technical, service orientation, and all that. So just recently I had a workshop now where the company or the client that I'm at the moment, they're going through a merger where a bigger company has bought them. So there's of course a difference between the two, but they try to merge, and there's two very different cultures in those two organizations. So we are looking exactly at this moment into how can we make that organization into one, and then also avoid running into the bureaucracy. That's the default, right? When people think of design organization, is they start at the top and then it trickles down. So the next level, actually in the current organization, they start with L1, L2, L3, L4. So they, each level, they have to design sort of their own departments, if you like. So L2, and then they have to bring in their people and design how they are going to work. And then the next level is going to design what they are going to do. So it's very top down. And you get the bureaucracy out of that. And you also, like we do in an industry, we end up creating functional organizations all the time. So there's like, here's the UX people and here's the business people, and you know, there's IT over here. IT is lucky if it's at the top level. Usually it's on a technology somewhere, which this organization has decided to do. So it's the customer, supplier, delivery between business and IT. So, you know, that's the default. And I think we need to rethink that default, replace it with something else. So that was a long-winded answer to say.
Thank you so much. I think you conveyed a lot of key points of your work these days. João?
Yeah, I also have a similar background. So I'm software engineer by training, right? And start working at like that, work at different countries, right? I'm Portuguese, but I work in Ireland, and currently we are in Netherlands. And I always have been attracted to the intersection of technology, right? In this case, software and management. Always, you know, do a bit of management, get things wrong, get back to coding, always on this yin and yang. And about 5 years ago, I want to try consultancy, but not the big consultants that are always traveling around the world, but something more niche. I started doing that in a company that still exists in the Netherlands. And this is where I start to see more and more of these patterns, right? We have new pieces of technology, very similar to what Trond was saying. We try to bring this technology or these practices to the workplace, but we never account how this is going to change us. Or even simpler, back in the day when teams start practicing continuous delivery, that radically changed their workflow, but no one could predict that. So I start seeing these patterns at team level, but also at organizational level. And this is what drew me to social technical, actually triggered by Nick Thune in a domain-driven design conference. But then start looking to the, then I discovered Tavistock Institute, and then also follow part of Trond's work, start pulling this thread where there is this amazing body of knowledge that is tested everywhere, but not a lot on our field of work in IT. They did this a lot on mines and you know, factories, manufacturing, you know, bottles and, I don't know, cars and explosives, but they never went to IT. And then what I realize is that on IT, we are always trying to reinvent the wheel, the next big framework and next big thing, rather than we just look, well, we are humans. We have huge bodies of knowledge. What do we know from anthropology, what do we know from sociology, right? Because it's just humans using this technology to achieve something. And this is where I end up, right? Helping customers, supporting customers that want these more humane operating models, right? Where they, yes, leverage technology to do something, but respect humans, respect our condition, respect the fact that we get tired very quickly, right? Computer can process and keep processing that. My brain just gets tired. I need to relax and do different stuff. It's just my nature, right? And probably your nature as well. And this is what I try to bring and explore what others have been doing.
When we discussed the first, I think even at the same conference where we met with Joao, to resonate with some of the things you said, looking at organizations as socio-technical systems where we have to respect, let's say, the humans, or we have to understand the human nature that is involved in the organization. So, for example, there is a lot of conversations around, you know, reducing cognitive load on teams or encouraging collaborative decision making and using more democratic ways of organizing. I always been a bit skeptical, let's say, sometimes of all this talking about democratization and listening to everybody and so on. My mental model was, you know, at the end of the day, you have to generate business outcomes. So it's the market that decides, let's say, what an organization is for and the meaning of an organization at the end of the day, right? And so I found in my experience a little bit of a synthesis, let's say, of these two ideas that I had in, I was entertaining in my mind. On one side, I was pretty sure that, you know, a hierarchical, bureaucratic organization where are dehumanizing, are not effective. But on the other side, I always was skeptical of too much talking about, you know, respecting and democracy and so on when there was no business outcome attached to that. And I think another thing that I want to add and throw the ball back to you, I found some of these inconsistencies also in the discussions we have sometimes around agile, right? And we have this talking about relationships at the center. And if you look at the Agile Manifesto, but if you look at the Agile Manifesto, for example, there's almost no mention of markets and business outcomes and so on. So what do you think in terms of how much can we really be disruptive, let's say, in the way we organize to the mainstream narrative of organizations having to produce sustainable business outcomes and people having to be responsabilized, let's say, mainly through market outcomes and business outcomes?
There is lots of questions that let's
try to
answer.
Yeah, sorry, that's typical of our podcast. And our listeners already have shared comments like, you know, Simone, you have to talk less, you have to let the guests talk more. So let's try for the next questions.
No, it's perfectly fine. It's a fire chat. But let's unpack, because I have a few ideas and then we're going to derail and end up in a different place. But let's start. I encountered this definition of bureaucracy from Max Weber, can be defined as a system of administration based on rationality, hierarchy, rules, and impersonality. It's really thinking about, you know, this is just to make everything homogeneous, which was the thinking running back then, but still is there. So if we don't want just a big machine running and treat humans like machines or pieces of a big machine, we need to be radical, right? We really need to rethink how we are doing that. And I will leave this thread open so Trond can continue on this. Now, on the Agile bit, if I look back and I talk with some people from the Agile community from the beginning, I think that Agile was a counter movement to bad management. So these Agile people were feeling that the way to produce software was not the right one, and they just create that little island to create better software. And indeed, Agile, I don't see any trace that had these business outcomes in mind, right? Was, okay, let's just create better software. However, if you listen to some of these people that were involved, so 9 months ago, one of the persons that were involved, he was telling a story that they were coding something wrong, and he was talking with the customer. And back then, sending floppy disks back and forth, mm-hmm. installed stuff. But he was telling that back in the day, they had skin in the game. They developed software and pick up the phone, what was wrong, and put new software on floppy disks and send over the mail. They didn't ask anyone to send over the mail. And we tend to forget about that, right? And this thread was really, really good because show how they interact. I think that now, because we start to get a grasp of what software can do for us, things are way more complicated and complex, and things are way more interconnected, that we really need to stop and think if we need this hierarchy of power or not. And this is where I draw and go to the past, and Agile is not that far away to think about that. Now, in my experience, I see a new wave of C-level that have 40 plus years that don't believe on this narrative that older generations believe. They saw the cloud, they saw how many financial crises we already had, and we are on a good place in the world, right? We are still in Europe. This is a very safe place. Wars. And they don't take the things that are stable for granted. And I'm working with these people, and these people go, okay, we don't want the big consultancies. We don't want the narrative. We know that we need something unique, and we need to craft by ourselves, right? Start to apply more systems thinking. And this is good to see. So I see some seeds popping up that there are people thinking in a different way, looking to organizations in a different way, but not, I don't think that we're going to see a disruption like a big wave. And for instance, one person that really inspires me is a CIO in a Ukrainian bank. I worked with them last year, so during the war. And he said a thing to me that really, you know, put things in perspective, that the bank is a platform to rebuild the Ukrainian society after the war. So this person is already thinking about the bank is not the end goal. The bank is just a small node that is part of a bigger thing. And I see more and more people start thinking like that. So I don't think that we're going to have a revolution, but we're going to have an evolution. Slowly more and more people picking on this concept and moving forward. And now I'm going to give to Trond because I left some stuff open that I think that he's going to pick up.
I might go somewhere completely different as well. Because when you mentioned democracy, because that's an interesting concept, though. Because I don't know, it could be because I'm from Norway and democracy is really strong here and there's social democracy and all that. But I remember I was really sort of grabbed by that. And I saw that when I read about the social technical system design and the experience that was done after the war, the Second World War, obviously. There was a lot of focus on not necessarily that they wanted democracy for its own sake, but that democracy worked better for not only the people, but actually the way they produced software, not software, back then it was actually called. But I mean, the work that they were doing, the work, the output was better when they were allowed to collaborate and sort of invent their own work, design their own stuff, instead of having somebody outside do it for them. Because I suspect we are inherently want to be independent in certain ways. So when we go to work and sort of just accept orders, we are not doing the best job that we could have done. Because it's okay. If I get creative, like in a very, very strict bureaucracy, mind you, but still, if you get creative, you're probably disrupting the system, right? Because somebody else is not expecting you to be that, to do that. And there's effect. So even if you try to be like creative, you're sort of hitting it as like a sort of a ceiling where you're not necessarily being told not to do it, but you see that it has some negative effects and people are react to it and you get probably not so positive feedback all the time and you end up doing what you've been told. I think it was Peter Drucker who said that, I believe, or that if you have dead wood in your organization, either you hired dead wood or you hired fresh wood and killed it. So I think that's the effect that I think also Agile was trying back then. And so I view it a little bit as a democratization movement, but it's not. I don't think they were thinking that when they were doing it. They were just doing it because that's how they got worked on in a proper way. And they actually can be proud of what they produced. So they ended up taking control of things that probably they weren't necessarily allowed to do, but they did it. Like, so it's sort of a revolutionary thinking, actually, because they saw that the waterfall thing, then they did 5-10 years projects never worked out. So they had to do something. I mean, either that or leave the job and do something else. So I guess it was, and that's exactly the same thing that happened in the coal mines in England. The miners were so frustrated. They were so out of their wits about how terrible the situation was in these mines with all this new equipment and shifts and orders being bossed around and, you know, getting conflicts between shifts and fight, infights, absenteeism, you know, the whole thing. So they had to do something. And I think actually in a certain way, it's kind of similar. So that's where the democracy bit comes in, because it's an effect. That's how we can do make change. It's not democracy for its own sake. It's just how we can do things our own way.
Hey, you are listening to this episode on an audio-only version. Get the best of the experience by watching these and other episodes in video on YouTube. Go to YouTube and search for Boundless Conversations, or just take your browser and write blss.io/bcpy, all capital letters, and you get there. On YouTube, you'll be able to subscribe to our channel and get notifications when new episodes are released. You said something very interesting. You said, you know, people show up in organizations that normally they are told what to do. Mm-hmm. And we have characterized that as a, I don't want to say it's not normality for most of the people we maybe listening to this podcast, but we feel it a bit of a dystopian thing, right? You know, going to an organization, being told what to do. It's the core of industrial organizational thinking, right? The core of scientific management and so on. And instead, when I look into, for example, open systems theory, that is maybe the good moment to bring it up. When you say doing what you're being told to do, and we think about something, you know, something different that we want to achieve. You know, my question is, what is this different thing that we want to build, right? And normally, people maybe picture the alternative of being told what to do with more like collaborative consent systems, like sociocracy or deciding together or whatever. But for me, there is a massive piece lacking, which is entrepreneurship. Okay, so this idea of having skin in the game of what you do, not just having the right to collaborate in a decision-making process, but rather building your own space where you can be taking decisions. You can do what you decide to do and not what somebody tells you to do. Mm. So I would like, if possible, if you can maybe double-click into this, into why, for example, in open systems theory, there is this massively important role of clear agreements that cannot be overthrown by a leader, for example, which makes me connect a lot with what we have in Rand and Hay and in our 3O practice. So the idea that organization must be governed by contracts, which are very clear. So, for example, if the organization decides to invest into a new idea that you want to build as an employee, there needs to be a contract that it's kind of unbreakable, that gives you both the freedom to manage, for example, your budgets, but also maybe your salary depends on it or something like that. And there is no way that somebody can come and say, you know, let's close the contract, let's forget what we agreed, and you're no more able to manage your own resources. So maybe if you can double-click both of you in how do we push this idea of entrepreneurship and, in general, skin in the game, which also in a world which is much more complex, as Joao was talking about, it's maybe something that goes even beyond entrepreneurship and it goes into building resilience and optionality for yourself as a person or as a community or as a team. That would be fantastic. So if you can maybe just try to riff with this idea.
Yeah. I just want to grab something that you said initially here, Simon, is that you said when you go into a job, when you sort of go into an organization, you're being told what to do. And I guess most of us today, we don't feel like we're slaves. We have been detail how we do, but it starts the day that you see the ad, because the ad describes what your role and what you're going to do. Even in like in tech, you even say what sort of technology you're going to use, right? So when you apply for a job, you're already given a strict, narrow area what is expected of you. And that's where we come back to what I said earlier, is that you're going to feel like you have to do that for a long time. And then at some point, you might try to experiment, say, oh, maybe I can try something else. Okay, I'm going to try .NET stuff. That's a bit crazy, but like you try to mix things up. It's not like you're going to suddenly do a finger painting and you just a little bit, but already there you're going to meet like resistance, right? So you're put in a very tiny, narrow box. And that is what bureaucracy is all about, because you are part of a hierarchy and you're expected to do something that the one above expects you to deliver on your report, right? So you have to do that. It's not like a evil hierarchy necessarily, but I mean, people are put in that situation where they are reporting up, and there are expectancies on them, and even measurements and KPIs and whatnot, right? So they have to. You can't wear out of that, because then you break the system, as I mentioned earlier. So that hierarchy is what they in open system theory call EP1. That's a bureaucracy, right? Mm-hmm. The alternative, instead of saying that you're applying for an ad and you have to do this and this and this and that, you're applying for a job for solving a problem, say, right? So you're moving into an organization, you know what you're good at, and you're moving into a team in DP, in sort of the open system theory, and a team have a set of tasks that they need to be done. Ideally, you should be able to do everything in that team. But I mean, we are so specialized that that would probably not be feasible. I could do some some UI, UX things, but I'm not an expert at all. So I stick to my bits. But that's the thing. You're signing up for a purpose, for an assignment, for sort of a task assignment, a goal, if you like. So that's how you enter the organization. So you're actually free within the purpose of that team. You're free to do whatever you want. And of course, the team needs you. So they are probably going to say, oh, we lack some expertise on this and that, right? So it could be something like that, but you're not put in a position. And that's the thing, that team, and that's a huge difference, and I want to sort of pick up on that later on, is that the huge difference between DP1 and what the second one is called, DP2, is that the responsibility for goal setting, coordination, and control resides at least one step above where the actual work is happening. That's DP1. So it's management, right? It's either management or supervision or whatever. In the other model, there are no management, nobody controlling anyone. So that belongs within the team. So the team decides what their goals are. The team decides on how to control things. And the team decide how they coordinate within themselves and to other teams. That's the difference between the two. And of course, you could say, well, that could go off in a different direction. And as you said, there are business goals and all that. How do you manage that? Well, you have to collaborate with the rest of the organization. And the rest of the organization has a purpose. When you sign up for a job for a telco, you are not selling paintings. You're not like refurbishing houses. There is a purpose to that organization. So you have signed up for that purpose, and that is selling telco products to customers, right? And you have to do that in a good manner that brings in money for the owners. So you sort of sign up for that and not for doing that specific task. I'm going to do Java coding. Sorry,
mm-hmm.
Bit of a rant.
Joao. No, again, lots of notes. So Joao, please jump in, and then I will pick it up.
I'm sorry.
But this is the point, right? So what I want to add here is to put these two beautiful words, right? That is, bureaucracy tries to go for efficiency.
Yeah.
That's why it try to dehumanize. Just need to be very efficient. But you can be very efficient doing the wrong stuff. You are just doing that wrong stuff faster. So, right? Mm. So this is the structural part. But if we think about open systems, and as open systems, the three of us are a team and we are exposed to our environment, right? Let's say that we are consultants. We are exposed to our area of consultancy. Mm. So we learn from this environment. We learn that, you know, with COVID, there was more working from home and working remotely. We can take these signals out of the environment. And based on these, we create strategies, right? How do we tackle this, right? How do we tackle that? How do we tackle? What people don't understand, or what I think that happens, is that the word strategy got very dirty word, because it's like, oh, strategy is what C-level does. No, strategy is bounded to a timeline. If we are in a software development team, our strategy is for the next 2 weeks, next week, next month, right? How do we make this software more resilient? Therefore, we increase our uptime, right? So we have more transactions going. But the strategy of C-level might thinking about the next 3 to 5 years. Mm-hmm. Well, if we leave Europe and we go to Australia, what does it take? Do we need the same structures? What are the legal options? Can we buy a company? That are things that take more time. And this is the thing, thinking about the timeline, and now I get back to the efficiency part, is that if we are mindful about the timelines that we are playing, then we can think about being effective, right? And that is where, and this is based on the work of your company, right? The organization is a network of agents. And different agents are focused on different timelines, right? It's not management telling me what to do, but the people that work in management, actually, they are better to play, you know, in the timeline of 1 year to 3 years, or in the timeline of 3 years to 5 years. And maybe these coders, they are really good solving this problem for tomorrow and next 3 months, right? But let these units be independent, and as Tron said, there is a purpose. Right, the company is a telco company. The company is not building Formula One cars. Right, if you want to build Formula One cars, join a Formula One company. They also have awesome software, right? Which is a different business. And I think that this is the, I will not say the revolution part, but actually this is getting back to what it was before the industry revolution, because pre-industry revolution, people just work in marketplaces. We collaborate together to do something, and then we go and do something else. There wasn't this idea of big enterprises with prescribed, you know, jobs. There was, we're going to do something, and three of us get together, and we did something. And then we split and go do something else. Job done. So, and this is the stuff. And because we humans, we live less than 100 years, right? 82 or 83, whatever is the average expectation of life. Industrial Revolution looks like ages ago. But if we look to the history of humans, it's thousands and thousands of years. Actually, we operate as networks for a long time. Then we operate with this hierarchy of power, which is right when we start studying is this type of thing. So to circle back, because I'm throwing lots of ideas, is this idea of do we just want to be efficient or organizations wants to be effective? Because if organizations wants to be effective, they need this space built in for people discovering these boundaries and keep realigning with the goals.
Yeah, just a little add on there, because what you're alluding to is that many organizations today are viewed as a machine, right? They are, efficiency is about to making the machine chug along as efficiently as possible. There shouldn't be any energy loss, there shouldn't be any failures and all that stuff. So, and even like the DP1, they actually call that for redundancy of parts, you can replace parts and the machine would still work as before. And that means that machine is tailored on doing one thing out. That's a bit of reductionist, but just imagine that it's specifically tailored to do one thing. And you can do that really, 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 really well. But that assumes that thing that machine does is like what is expected of it. But at some point, like for example, when we now are turning to electric cars, like the diesel cars are not something we want anymore, right? So the environment change. And if you have an organization that is drilled to do one thing well, it's very brittle. Mm-hmm. It doesn't adapt change that well. So that's why you have to rethink. I mean, the whole idea of sort of efficiency, you have to be effective, as I said. And if you're going to be effective, you need the whole organization. You can't have just one at the top or some few at sort of designing the whole thing. Everybody have to be sort of involved in it. You need all the brain power in the organization to make change, not just mm-hmm. if you want, especially not management consultancies.
And this is the interesting stuff, right? So we come from IT. I don't know how is the audience versus on IT, but Google has set up a set of practices called site reliability engineering. And I even talk with testers that work at Google, and they came from a more traditional testing that they know where the system starts and where the system ends. And this means that you know the full system, but when they arrive to Google, you don't know where the system starts and the system ends because Google is massive. Hmm. So Google has a set of practices, alluding to what Trond was saying, that is, for teams to have this flexibility, is called budget errors, right? So they have service level agreements and service level objectives, and let's say that is 98% of uptime. So the team knows that they have these 2% to do experiments and to try to innovate, because they know that at that level they do money, and the rest is for them to play. And in the book of SRE are even stories of teams that were consistent above that, that they provoke outages to be with budget error. If not, the system was just too perfect. They want people to understand that these systems break. And what you see at Google, now looking back, is that this culture of Google came out from the garage culture that they had, that you had one day per week that you could work on your project. Mm-hmm. But a couple of years back, Google started to be really attracted to efficiency. So they cut all of this type of stuff. They saw the innovation going down, and now they are bringing these practices back because they see the organization, for instance, with the race for artificial intelligence, they are not able to compete. And they are not able to compete because they try to be more efficient. Mm. It's simply as that. Let's shop this time. Why people are spending one day per week innovating? No, do their job. And now they need to innovate. No one knows how to innovate because no one has space to think. So it's very, very interesting how this happened at scale of Google. And if this happens at scale of Google, if the other companies are just focused, blindly focused on this efficiency, they are brittle. They are not resilient.
I'm actually picking up on something you said at the tail end of your question, was that how do you secure this thing? Say if you're an association decided you wouldn't, enough of this bureaucracy, we want to let people do whatever they want, we don't have something higher or bootstrap or whatever, and we want to do that. Sure, you can redesign an organization, but you probably do that because there are some heroes higher up that say, yes, we're going to do this, right? And they have to fight for it, most likely, because there's so much bureaucracy and so much management, and there are so many people that's probably going to lose their job because they are probably there. Some of them are there, actually, we have to admit, are there to control or manage other people. They are not necessarily doing productive work, which is what you want out of an open systems, a DDP2 organization. There shouldn't be any fluff. Everybody should do productive work in all parts of the organization, be it in any time span or whatever. But how can you make sure that that doesn't break and fall back, as you mentioned, Joe, about Google? And that's where you actually have to think bigger than the organization. You have to go wider to end up to manage that. In Australia, one of the heroes of open system theory, Fred Emery, was part of introducing this. On the country level, they replaced a sort of a work contract approach that they had and introduced something they called enterprise bargaining agreements. Which means that in Norway we have something similar where sort of the unions sort of represent the employees and the employers, they go into an agreement and then they sign and all this stuff. Mostly about pay and all free time and all that stuff here. But in Australia, that's actually per company. So if the company decides to reorganize towards another structure, say DP2 like, they can put it in contract, which means that you can't break it easily. You can always, go back and renegotiate the contract, but then you have to actually get agreement that you want to go back to the one like Google did. Unfortunately, sorry for saying this, but the bureaucracy is so ingrained in us, and it's so easy to break the DP2 by having some authoritarian person coming in, especially at the top. We can't have all that free time. We need to be efficient. They did at Google.
Right.
So then it falls back. So you have to, unfortunately, that's how the world is today. It's so ingrained that we have to enforce the new version, and we have to do that with agreements.
Trond, you said solving a problem, right, versus executing what I'm being told, which is the biggest difference that you have, and you have indicated as essential in really different organizations. So if you are working to solve a problem as a team, and you have a whole capability to deliver this kind of value proposition that solves a problem, for me, this resonates a lot with the idea of having a customer, right? So having someone that it has a problem you are solving. In larger organizations, I tend to see that some of the teams that we work with are more market-facing. They're actually solving a problem for an end user, for a customer. Some other are having internal customers, which still makes a lot of sense, you know, and there's a lot of talking in organization of platform engineering and exporting services outside of the organization and letting the market enter inside the organization. So you still responding to a customer. And in some other cases, there are some functions or some structures inside the organization that tend to receive budgets, more like, you know, the customer is the shareholder, let's say, no, the boss, the management that allocates budgets for certain work that these teams can do. I kind of connect this with the idea of purpose that you spoke about. So if I have a purpose as an organization, I kind of naturally generate this capital or resources-based hierarchical relationship where someone is going to provide me with resources to do the job they want me to do, because it's maybe, you know, it's not a traditional problem I'm solving, but somebody is giving me money to do a work that they suspect it's important for the organization. So what I wanted to say with this is that imagine an organization when everybody solves a customer problem and there is little or not internal budgets. This is very market-oriented organization. And it's likely that such an organization is less purposeful. So it's more like adaptive, like, you know, there is an opportunity, I'm going to do that. And when I talked to Jean Grumin a few years ago, he said, the future of hire, I pictured it as a company like water, where there is no purpose. It's much more adaptive as a company. And instead, when I think about purpose, I tend to connect this with a hierarchy, bureaucracy, replicability, productivity, and to some extent, it makes me think that purpose is a very much an industrial concept. It's I would say a category of an industrial society, you know, together with productivity. My question is, when we started to think about teams and real democracy and it kind of entails that you have to reduce the reach of purpose inside the organization and push a bit the internal locus of control into teams. So teams needs to be much more autonomous and say, you know, we want to do this. We decide what to do. We bear the consequences. For example, we create a lot of relationships with external or other partners so that we rely less on a single source of income or capital or purpose. And we tend to generate many more options, you know, that we can rely on as a team. So in pushing this kind of responsibility of defining their own strategy, future vision inside teams, you know, isn't this conversation really disruptive to the very idea of an industrial organization? So are we really ready to engage with an organizational theory that puts teams and people back into the complexity of survival, let's say, you know, and resilience and optionality, and removes all these kind of secure systems of control that are embedded in how we think about organizations in the industrial society?
I actually want to go back to what is core to open system theory first here, because and that's the individual, not that the individual is just there because it's part of something bigger, but an individual is there defined as an open purpose system, just to use the system theory thinking again, which means that you are exposed to the environment, but there is a purpose to you, that you have a purpose, there's something that you want out of life. It could be anything in every context, obviously, but when you sign up for a job, you want to align your purpose with that company's purpose. I wouldn't be a slave owner, for example, even though that like just an extreme example, though. But or I wouldn't want to build cars that ruin the environment, for example. I want to be something where I can feel proud of what I do at work. I want to, but not only that, and I also want to fit in. I want to be part of something bigger. An organization is just, it's not just a random selection of parts or people. It has to be, there is something that joins you. There is something that you want to do together. That's what creates an organization out of you. Of six number of people, for example. There is something that you want to build together. There's something that you want to create. And that goes for the teams as well, and it goes for the company as a whole. So I think purposefulness has not, at least from my perspective, nothing to do with with industrial thinking necessarily, even though there is obviously a purpose there. But the difference is that the purpose there is controlled from the top in the bureaucracy, that the whole thing is designed and the purpose is set on top, and then you just have to do your part to fit into that purpose. But that doesn't mean that you agree on the purpose. It doesn't mean that you like what you're doing, but you're just doing it because it's a job and you get the money and you get to do whatever you want to do outside of the office door. So actually your life becomes everything but the work. Work is just a way to get money, right? But if you enjoy your work, you actually get some purposefulness out of it. That's when you sort of, you've probably been in a situation where you feel like, oh, you're so energized. I always feel that when you have a workshop or something like that, because we collaborate and we create something new, and you go out from the workshop buzzing, literally buzzing. And that's where when your purpose is aligned with the rest of the people that you're working with. So I think this is sort of the core to make teams that actually function well, is to measure, are people actually feeling that their purposes or their needs are met. In open system theory, they have something called the six criteria, which is a sets of measurements that you do, three of them for personal measurements and three of them for sort of the team and the collaboration. So the goal of having a good team is having good scores on those. That's it. Mm-hmm. So it is, even though it's not the individual on his own, it's the measure of the individual's feeling of being at work that matters. And then you get the most of the other people. Then you get creativity, you get commitment, you get responsibility, you get honor, you get pride. You know, all those things, you wouldn't get that in that bureaucracy necessarily.
It's also this old definition of purpose, right? And I think that this gets back, right? And this is a very personal story. So in Portugal, when you go to school, since young age, is to be sit down, looking to the teacher and learning. So all of the creativity is removed from you from very young age. This happened with me. And now we have a daughter and we are in the Netherlands and stay in the Netherlands because the education system is open. Actually, they want the kids to try different stuff and touch, right? To learn by that. And this is a big difference. I think that we are being so conditioned, especially around these ideas of purpose. And I agree with you that purpose is this industrial purpose, that we forget that also there are different levels of purpose. And your purpose change. My purpose is not the same one that was 15 years ago or 10 years ago or, you know, after being a father. My purpose change. The problem is that we don't allow ourselves or we are conditioned not to allow ourselves to realign and talk about these things, right? Just run for the money. And I think that the problem lies there. I understand the metaphor of organization is just water, is super adaptive, which means for me that people change their mind and change their purpose and keep just flowing left and right. And now we are on that top position and in 2 months we are. As Western society, we don't like that. We just want people to conform to whatever boxed society produces today. And that's it, right? Because in the end, I think that you have a purpose. Personal purpose, and that change as well. It's these, are we talking and realigning with a bigger group? Because we are a group animal. As any animal, we are a group animal. We need the group. We are nothing alone, right? We are a group animal. We are a social animal. And we achieve things together. Do we allow ourselves to have this conversation?
Just a little add on to that is that there is a girl called Andreas Angeal, which is a central character in the early development of what became open system theory as a psychologist. He was thinking in open systems. So he's saying that you as a person, you have a need for autonomy. We often talk about autonomy organization, right? We are not want autonomous teams and all that stuff. And especially across the pond, there's a lot of focus on the individual. Like, you have to be autonomous, you have to make your own man, you be your own hero and all that stuff. But the ideas here are that humans, yes, they need autonomy, but they also need something that he called homonymy. They need to belong. They need to fit in. That's what Zhao said. We are group animals. I think Marilyn Emery, which is something which is one of the trailblazers and who is actually also still alive, at least in Australia, she said that in an interview that if a person gets isolated, the person is going to wither away and die. And that is I think that's a thought to bear in mind. Mm-hmm. Yes, you can choose to isolate yourself, but if you're forced out, different story.
I feel it very interesting, this idea that purpose doesn't need to be seen necessarily as an industrial idea that, you know, you as a leader, you are going to impose the purpose and then, you know, hierarchically organize and bureaucratize the organization to produce the purpose, but rather that purpose is a kind of a dynamic thing, and people look for purpose alignment, and there's a lot of a little bit also of memetics and leadership in this, because we cannot negate that purpose is often a product of sources in organization and leaders that can kind of influence the purpose and use their gentle ways to influence the purpose to make organization, democratic organization, a bit more scalable. Because otherwise, you know, if everybody decides whatever they want to do, you know, you cannot have any replicability. You don't really generate any efficiency in the organization, and you have to create some kind of efficiency in organization. And if you can do it through this kind of gentle purpose alignment facilitated by leadership and source capabilities, this is how these type of organizations work. But one thing that I wanted to use as a bridge for a last reflection, you know, you spoke about complexity, changes, the war, and the markets are transforming, and the world is becoming more multilateral. And for sure, you know, the Washington consensus is gone. You know, the predictability of the industrial age is gone. You know, it's no more about planning. It's much more about adapting. Things are changing all the time. So I see that when Trond, you spoke about belonging, for example, right? And maybe isn't it time that we build a theory of organizations for a real complex world, right? And is it possible that belonging that we have used mostly as employees to belong to brands and organizations that play a role in a much more predictable and planned society may have to shift more into belonging to something that is much more, a little bit more antagonistic or embedded maybe in place or in community, much more in something like more diverse and individualistic, I would say atomistic, versus the kind of this kind of fake belonging that we have used in the industrial age to feel ourselves, you know, attached to a brand or an organization that at the end of the day was just making money.
One of the sort of early introduction, or not invention, but sort of description of open system theory was around the environment. So conceptualizing the environment that an organization or a group is sort of part of. Like in the industrial era, we assumed that things were predictable. There was competition, but it was all about, you know, winning the mound, like becoming the king of the hill or whatever it was like. You have to win the market. So it's all about strategy and all that stuff and getting the right people and cost cutting and all that stuff. That works in one certain environment where things are fairly predictable. If your company do something, you're going to bet your ass that somebody else is going to do the same thing and they're going to do this and this and that. So it's all about just maneuvering. But the thing is that the environment that we are in now is highly unpredictable. And that's where complexity comes in. The open system theory people don't use complexity as a term, but they use unpredictability. And it's been highly unpredictable, well, they actually say after the war. And it's not because the world in itself has sort of changed so much, but because we have changed so much after that. We stopped believing in our governments. We you had the Cultural Revolution and people are the hippie age and all that stuff. So people just don't trust as much as they do. So their whole environment, sort of the social aspects change. And so if a company today say, oh, we are going to go full in, like a few years ago, we are going to full in on diesel engines, right? Yeah, that's brilliant because they are low cost, they are low cost and they're efficient, la, 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 la. And then suddenly you have this environmental movement and then nobody wants diesel cars anymore. So, I mean, that's sort of the unpredictability that sort of the companies find themselves in. And that's where the open system theory really shines, is because they take that in fully. You can't predict anything. Everything is unpredictable. So you have to create an organization that can adapt to anything. And that's when you need the full brain power of the whole organization. You can't just rely on some brilliant person at the top. Apple had that for some time, right? So there are some examples of that, but that's for the majority of companies, that doesn't work anymore. Simply doesn't work. You need all the antennas that you can have.
That is the thing. When you have this question about, do we need a new organizational theory? I think that we already have. But because even if we pull the thread of open systems theory, open systems theory is two things. And this is also what happened with social technical systems. It's a body of knowledge, but also it's a framework and a set of practices, which makes things really confusing. Because OST, open systems theory, also offer practices to scan the environment, realign, and reorganize if the organization wishes. And I think that is there. What also it's very important is that we touch a bit about seeing the world as a big machine. With open systems theory, it is rooted on everything is contextual. Of course, we are consultants and we can put the joke, it depends. But it's really the context. For that company is different, right? It can be two banks here in Netherlands, but the bank has a budget that is 50% higher than the other. So the context is totally different. This is just one variable. I get back to what I said. We are not trained since kids to understand this. We are trained that everything is equal, everything is standard, and this gets to our brain. Yes, I understand that if now we are radical, or at least if we start transforming the workplace, I think that we're going to affect the next generation of kids rather than trying to go and change the educational system. And this was a realization that I had. I told you that I jumped between software engineering and management and lots of this stuff. This was a realization that I had because after I have this realization, I went, ha, now I know how to be a parent. It's really hard to allow my daughter to be an open system, but really pays off. Because now the autonomy on her decisions and understanding the world is higher. And I see, now I understand our new generation of people can coming up. And I think that this is what can unlock, you know, to the what Ron was saying, that after the war, we don't trust governments and stuff like that, to start to increase the trust between each other, humans, right? This is it's important. Probably will not happen on our lifetime, but at least I make my purpose.
I hope so, honestly, because I feel like our future depends on this. But
yeah, but at least I make my purpose to do this and to preach and to have right. My consultancy practices to get a bit closer, right? Doing my bit.
We have found a new purpose, haven't we, Charles?
Yes.
Thank you so much. I mean, let's use just a few minutes more for you to point our listeners to something very important they need to check, read, watch. Maybe something easy that can also onboard them into open systems theory or other things that you believe are essential that maybe changes your perception as well.
I can give one that I like. It's this red book on the back that is Good Services. So it's a person that for a long time worked in UK government. It's on the area of user research and user interaction. But if people want to start getting into system thinking, holist thinking, you know, have this service centricity and what a service means. It's a great book because although it's a big book, it's thick, it's well made and has amazing stories, how things go wrong when people don't think about the system. I really like that one because it doesn't go crazy on theory. Hmm. And you go, oh, because lots of these stories are on newspapers in the UK. You go, oh, okay, now I understand this systems thinking view. So I highly recommend that book as a, you know, as a starter. And then if you want to pull the thread, I will leave that to Trond to give more resources.
No, because of course I could say, yeah, you should get the Marilyn Emery's searching book. It's actually available still. But, you know, if you really want to learn about system theory, that's a decent book. But it's really hard to read. It's an academic book, and it's not approachable for anyone unless you've read a lot of it. You actually have to know a bit about it before you read the book to understand it. So I sort of can't really recommend it. And that's also which have been our conundrum, because I read, as I said, numerous papers and even like that book and others. And it taken me like since before COVID, I think I started in 2019 reading this stuff. So I spent years reading papers and papers and papers. So of course I could recommend a few of them, and I have done on my blog. But the thing is that there isn't really a book I can hand you and say, start here. I mean, the one that Joe mentioned, it's not like from that specific thing, but it has the elements in it, of course. So that's where we decided to write it ourselves. We wanted to have a sort of an easy introduction to the whole way of thinking. So, I mean, we started this because we had to, because people ask us all the time, oh, do you have a book you can recommend? Not really. So maybe we can condense all the learning we had and reading all the papers and make it like a dummies introduction to open system theory. Also based in IT, which is also, as Yao said, it's not something that open system theory had.
We will put in the notes, by the way, your blog where you point at least the people to some interesting reads, and we're looking forward to read your book coming up. So, I mean, it was a crazy interesting conversation for me, very much into the white hot core of the discussion I wanted to have. I thank you so much for your time. I hope you also enjoyed the conversation.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah, for our listeners, of course, as always, you will find all the notes, all the information about Trond's and Joao's work on our website. If you go to boundless.io/resources/podcast, there will be this episode you can check first, and then you can read the notes and the links. Until we speak again, remember to think boundaryless.